Kedvach, Shavua Tov, Gemar Chasima Tova, to each and every one of you, and thank you so much for joining me. This is, for me, a feeling of deja vu all over again. It seems like, well, it was 6 months ago, more or less, that I sat from this very place, this bunker of sorts, to give my first virtual Shabbos Haggadol Drasha. And while I can't be sure, I'm fairly certain that at the time, I had assumed that by the time Shabbat Shuvah would come around, we would be able to gather in a more familiar and a more traditional setting. But I begin tonight by acknowledging and sort of stating the obvious, and that is that once again, this year's Shabbat Shuvah Drasha will be different for all the obvious reasons, the fact that we are meeting here virtually, which I'm glad we are able to do, is certainly less than ideal. I'm sitting rather than standing, which again may seem like a very little consequence at the moment, but there is a certain formality, a traditional formality to this drasha, and my decision to sit together with you at this time is a departure from that, and I feel it should be noted. And finally, as you heard me say before Shabbos HaGadol, I'll say again right now, this will not be, at least for myself, a typical Shabbat Shuvah Drasha. Obviously, I'm not handing out sheets, but I'm not going heavy on the sources. This is not a well-developed shiur. I have not taken a sugya and decided to take it apart and share it with you as a means of gaining some perspective during this very important time. What I will be doing, however, is reflecting with you from where we are, and try to make this as meaningful of an experience for each and every one of you as possible. I want to also begin by sort of saying from the outset what I will not be doing. I will not be talking tonight about what we can learn from the COVID-19 crisis. I think the record will show that there has been a lot of that already. I myself have, I would say countless times, tried to take very, very important perspectives and encourage each and every one of us to do so during this time. And I don't think that we have exhausted that conversation entirely, but that is not my focus for this evening. And I want to begin that way because I think it may seem at certain points as if that's what I'm doing. And I'm not. And I finally want to apologize from the outset because I think it is inevitable that some of the things that I say tonight may upset some people in a way that is unintended. To be clear, I don't intend on saying anything particularly controversial. My mussar tonight will be pretty light. That being said, I recognize that we are living through a time of great confusion and worry, and emotions are still very high. And I think it is almost impossible to talk about this without some people feeling as if their toes are being stepped on. And for that, I apologize from the outset. Tonight is Erev Yom HaKippurim, which is the beginning of the ninth day of the Aseres Yemei Tshuva. At this point in the season, almost 40 days in since we started talking about Tshuva on Rosh Chodesh Elul, I think it's fair to say that we all have a basic idea of what Tshuva is in its most elementary form and how it applies to specific sins and actions and concrete behaviors. But there's another element to Tshuva which we don't always focus on quite as much, and that is the underlying character traits which motivate us to act the way that we do. Now, in the past, I have reflected upon tshuva from two different modalities and perspectives within the field of psychology. I have emphasized that the importance of embracing what we would call sort of a behavioral approach towards change, recognizing that there are concrete and actionable steps that we can take in order to break habits and in order to achieve goals that seem from time to time unattainable. That being said, the traditional approach, which sort of lay the groundwork at the foundation for the modern world of psychology, reflects a completely different perspective, highlighting the inner world and the mind and the soul of a person, an approach which also always, from time to time, involves various degrees of what we call psychoanalysis, and I don't think that we should accept or embrace one particular approach over the other. But we should recognize and acknowledge that often in life we act a certain way because of aspects of our personalities that need to be discovered and that need to be acknowledged. Now, the Rambam did not write a formal Musar Sefer, But in the Mishnah Torah, there's a section in which the Rambam talks about character development, in which the Rambam very clearly highlights and focuses on specific areas in which we need to watch our behaviors. And the Rambam calls this Hilchos Deos. The Rambam specifically identifies this section of the Mishnah Torah as a section in which we are going to recognize that we behave a certain way, by and large because of who we are, because of how we think, because of how we feel. And I think it's important to recognize and to focus not only on what we do, but to consider who we are, which may give us some insight into why we do what we do. It's a very beautiful article I'd like to refer you to. You can find it on the Virtual Base Medrash on the Yeshivat Haritzvon website from Aaron Lichtenstein, Zichrono Livracha. The title of the article is Yazov Rasha Darko. And over there, Rav Aaron points out how the Rambam in the Hilchos Tshuva seems to talk about two different profiles of Balei Tshuva. In the first six chapters, the Rambam focuses very much on behaviors and actions. And he walks us through the various steps of Tshuva so we understand how it is that a person can effectively change who they are and can commit themselves to a process of change. But in the last chapters of Hilchos Tshuva, the Rambam talks about not so much the behaviors, but who a person is. And he talks specifically about the ways of a person. Again, citing that pasuk, as I just mentioned, Yazov Rasha Darko, that a Rasha should look not only to change his actions, but his derech, who he is. Perhaps take a close look at his entire value system, understanding how he feels and how he thinks. Now, there is a very fascinating pattern that I would like to share with you tonight that we can note within the Al-Chetz that we will be saying again and again and again, beginning tomorrow afternoon and through Yom HaKippurim. We typically view the section of the Al-Chetz part of davening as being somewhat random and disjointed. There are lots of examples of sins, but there's not seem to be much order to it other than the alphabet. And that leaves us perhaps feeling somewhat unsatisfied, for lack of a better word, both in terms of presentation as well as import. But there may be something very deep and very profound that we can reveal and discover within the Al-Chetz. The Al-Chetz may actually be calling our attention to this very important phenomenon, that our actions are not to be considered out of context, as if our sinful behaviors are happening in a vacuum. There are underlying reasons and causes for what we do. And so I'll give you several examples, and I hope this will challenge you and interest you enough that over the course of the next 48 hours, you will be able to look perhaps a little more deeply and meaningfully at the Al-Chetz. So for example, we say, Al-Chetz shechatanu lefanecha bevitoi svasayim. We recognize and acknowledge, of course, and we are all guilty of this, that we utter with our lips things that we shouldn't. We say things that are hurtful. We say things that are harmful. We say things that are inappropriate. These words come out of our lips. And how does this happen? So the answer may be, look at the phrase immediately beforehand. Al-Chetz shechatanu lefanecha bivli das. You know how we get to bitoi svasayim? Because we don't think. How often do we say, oh, I should have been thinking, or I would not have said that? Another example. Al-Chetz shechatanu lefanecha bigilui arayos. Gilui arayos, in its broadest sense, means acts of immorality, technically sexual immorality, and of course there's a spectrum. There are many different behaviors that fall within the wide range of what would be considered gilui arayos. But I think we can ask ourselves, how could it be? How could a frum Jew stand before Hashem on Yom Kippur and have to say, Al-Chetz shechatanu lefanecha bigilui arayos? Where does that come from? Acts of sexual immorality? And the answer is, take a look immediately beforehand. Al-Chetz shechatanu lefanecha bigilui vasaser. Acts of immorality developed from a mindset, then I could be one person in public and I could be someone else when I'm alone. When I fail to recognize and to appreciate Shivisi Hashem lenegdi tamid, that Hashem is always with me, so I could, God forbid, find myself in lots of trouble. Al-Chetz shechatanu lefanecha b'honaas reya. I have hurt my friends, my family, people I love. How could I do that? And again, you see the pattern. Right beforehand, Al-Chetz shechatanu lefanecha b'hirur alev. Because we keep so much bottled up in our hearts. We are in violation of what the Torah says, lo sisna esachicha bilvavecha. If something is bothering you, don't hold it in. Share it with the person you're upset at. Because what will happen is it will build up and then it will express itself in ugly ways. If we do not take care of the chatoim of hirur alev, we will end up with hana'as reya. Hashem. We are often horrified when we see acts of public desecration of Hashem's name. How does this happen? How can someone do such an awful thing? And the answer is it doesn't happen out of nowhere. When we become entrenched in our views, stubborn in our thinking, unwilling to recognize anything outside of my own personal interests and needs, so then the stage has been set. God forbid for Chil Hashem. Lying, falsehood, committing acts of fraud and betrayal. How does one stoop to such lows? And here again, it doesn't come from nowhere. Sometimes, something as innocuous as and benign as accepting a bribe, the chapas shochad, so that becomes the first step. Very often starts with, I was being cynical, I was just making a mockery and a joke, and I was just making a joke. And those jokes can sometimes snowball and become very, very harmful in the form of lashon hara. That I stood there brazenly, feeling as if I had to answer to no one. And that starts with Einayim Ramos. Beritzas raglayim lahara. How do I find myself running to do bad? The answer is it starts with rechilos, an attitude in which I just walk around from one place to the other, spreading gossip here and there. It snowballs, it grows. This again is an insight, but I hope we can use it as a springboard to understand how important this type of analysis is. And this analysis, self-analysis, is important for several reasons. Number one, we sometimes wonder, how did we end up where we are? What has brought me to act the way that I am acting? How could I have possibly committed such acts? Acts that truly embarrass me? And the answer is sometimes we have to take a look, closer look, and gain more insight and perspective, not in terms of what we're doing, but who we are. And it's also important because if we really want to correct our ways, not just in the moment, if we don't just want to patch ourselves and put on a little Band-Aid to get through the day of Yom HaKippurim, but become better people, so then we need to recognize that sometimes we need to scratch deeper beneath the surface if we want to create meaningful and lasting change. The past 6 months, I'm not even sure where to begin. If I would look back at my own personal notes and correspondence with some of you and others, and shiurim that I've given, it reads like a frightening diary. And I don't, as I mentioned before, I don't want to get sucked in right now and go down the rabbit hole of talking about all the things that we can and should learn from the COVID crisis. As I mentioned earlier, that's not my focus for this evening. I don't want to talk about the things that we could learn about life and values and simchas and davening, what's really important, what's not important. Again, an important conversation, but not for now. I do think, however, it's worthwhile for us to spend time focusing on what we have learned about ourselves, the roots that have been exposed over the past unprecedented 6 months. We have experienced something which is unprecedented and quite impactful, and it has revealed many aspects of our personalities, our value systems, things that were there all along, but perhaps we did not notice. And I don't think it's appropriate to focus this only from a critical perspective. Vidui is not only on sins. There's a concept of reciting vidui even on the things that we get right. There is no question. There are many things that we can discover about ourselves. I will start with the positives tonight. I'm not going to be spending as much time on that, but I'll start with that. Positive things that we have learned and discovered about ourselves over the past 6 months. Our ability to adapt. We are truly adaptable people as individuals, as families, as communities. It is remarkable to see our ability to adapt to the sudden needs that we faced. We could never have known this about ourselves. And all things considered, I think that we have done remarkably well. How many of you were able to connect tonight much easier than you would have been able to 6 months ago? And even though we're not using Zoom, which is relatively complicated to wait in a waiting room and to mute yourself, we've all become experts. And I'm using this as a silly example, but we've really adapted. Our response as a community, in many aspects throughout this entire crisis, we have been there for each other, leveraging so many different components of our community to support and assist each other, which is remarkable. We could not have known this about ourselves before. The creativity on a programming level, educational materials that have come together from so many institutions and individuals, it's really amazing. The communication that despite all of the limitations and restrictions of social distancing, we have been able to effectively maintain and in some respects strengthen our social network. And to be clear, this hasn't worked for everyone, and I don't want to sound as if everyone feels as if they are able to be on either end of the conversation when it comes to communication, but I think that we have a lot to show and that we have a lot to be proud of when we reflect over the last 6 months. The leadership that we have seen within our community, lay leadership, professional leadership, and even individuals who have stepped up and have become leaders on their own block, individuals who have suddenly, for the first time, discovered a part of themselves, their ability to show initiative and concern for individuals who have less and are not as naturally connected. These are all wonderful roots that have been exposed over the past 6 months. But tonight I want to focus a little more critically. And if there are examples that are positive, so we know that there are also examples in which we can look a little more critically at some of the negative and not as wonderful and positive roots that I just started with. Number one, the last 6 months has revealed that we have had until now a very false sense of control. We go through life believing in a whole set of givens and assumptions about what are the facts of life. We put tremendous faith and belief in these assumptions, and on a certain level we must. We have to be prepared and responsible and appropriately responsive to the realities of life the way we know them to be. But there's a great risk, because when we give ourselves over completely to these assumptions, then we run the risk of believing that these realities will always be this way and things will never change. Several months ago, I saw a fascinating article written by a ICU physician. His name is Dr. Stephen Grove. And he wrote an article. I'm not going to read the entire article, but I want to read an excerpt to you. There is a common flaw, he writes, of human nature, which has been threatening our response to the pandemic on the whole. We tend to be overly present-centered. What I mean by that is we tend to assume that our current situation will continue without change. When things are bad, we assume it will never get better. When things are good, we assume they'll never get worse. Unfortunately, we experience and respond to this fallacy on a deep emotional and subconscious level. This quite obviously leads to major mistakes in judgment. Among the countless other systemic errors it leads to, it explains why we do poorly in the stock market. When the market is going up, we assume it'll go up forever. And when it's going down, we assume it'll go down forever. We end up buying high and selling low. This is not a recipe for success. We do the same thing with our relationships, job situations, and countless other things in our lives. This human flaw manifests in medicine on a nearly constant basis. People go to the doctor with a specific problem for which they are prescribed a medication. The medication solves the problem. Then they stop taking the medication because they feel better, not realizing that the medication was the reason they were feeling better. People stop their psychiatric meds when the mood improves, only to relapse. People stop taking the antibiotics early when they feel better, putting themselves at risk for resistant bacterial infections. And people stop taking their blood pressure medication because their blood pressure improves, only for it to rise again after stopping. In this pandemic, this human flaw feeds spread of the virus. As the cases have declined, people are consciously or unconsciously behaving as if the declines will continue indefinitely. They assume the phases can only progress forward, not backward. Unfortunately, there is nothing about the nature of this virus that would make that true. COVID-19 is down, but certainly not out. As long as there are cases in the community, we can end up right back where we started. Now, as I said before, and I know this sounds a little confusing, but I'm not talking about COVID protocols and procedures at this point. So I would ask you almost to forget the details of that. I'm using it as a mushel because it is timely and it is relevant. We crave certainty. We love certainty. We feel certain with our certainty. And unfortunately, we fail to recognize that one of the most important secrets to happiness and spiritual fulfillment and success in life is nothing is certain. In fact, everything is uncertain. David HaMelech declares, we say it each and every day in Perek Lamed of Tehillim, Va'ani amarti b'shalvi bal emot li'olam. David HaMelech says, I say b'shalvi, I say when things are peaceful and calm and tranquil, bal emot li'olam, they will never change. And the Malbim says, Ani chashavti she'hachayim v'habriyos heim tiviyam, I just take life and health for granted. It's natural. As long as I'm feeling healthy, I assume I will stay that way forever. And that's what he means. What that means is, as long as I'm feeling okay, Aval says the Malbim, but I realize now that no, my life and my health, this is a matter of divine providence. This is something which depends exclusively on God's ratzon, on his desire to sustain this status quo. And so therefore, histarta panecha, at that moment that you turn your face from me, hayisi nivhol, I become suddenly flustered. I don't know how to handle that. But the reality is that uncertainty is the greatest gift, because if we pay attention, it reminds us that we can't be certain of anything. There's only one thing in this world that we could be certain of. We said it on Rosh Hashanah, we're going to say it again on Yom Kippur. Havadai Shemo Kein Tehilasa. The way we praise Hashem is by reminding ourselves that His name is Vadai. That is the only thing that we can be certain of. And we remember with great nostalgia life when it was normal. My friends, this is normal. The irony of the Hefkeris of the past 6 months, this is normal. Everything else is a facade. The only thing that we can know about life is that there's nothing to really know. And that sense of invincibility, of complete control, of kochi v'yotzem yadi, that I can control everything about my life, that is a facade, is a mistake. And so therefore, as unsettling as this time has been, it has been a gift, because it shines the light on ourselves. It exposes these roots, this false sense of control and certainty that we have in the world. And now is a time to correct it. Because I do hope and pray, we've been davening, Avinu Malkeinu Menah Magefa Minachal Asecha, that things will return to normal, but we don't want that we should return to normal. We don't want to come to that point, as David HaMelech says, Ani Amarti B'Shalvi Balemot Li'olam, because that's not the right attitude. Things do change. Gam Ze Yavor. Whatever it is, wherever you are, it's going to change. If things are really, really tough, and you're going through a really hard time, we should tell ourselves, Gam Ze Yavor, it's going to get better. It's not going to be this terrible forever. And if things are going really well, and you're riding high, Gam Ze Yavor, this too shall pass. The second root, which I'd like to shine a light on tonight, is the sense of impatience, I will say, that we have displayed over the past 6 months. Of course, in all fairness, we could not have prepared for this, and we need to give ourselves credit for our success, as I mentioned, in adapting to this situation. But looking back, one has to wonder whether or not, at certain points along the way, and even now, we have failed and we continue to fail to demonstrate an adequate degree of patience. And I would prefer not to focus on specific examples, because that would serve nearly as a distraction, and they would likely trigger the type of reactivity that I think would be counterproductive in the context of tonight's conversation. I think it would just be beneficial for us to focus on the value of patience. We say that patience is a virtue. It's a virtue from a Torah perspective. Is there a mitzvah in the Torah that says, thou must be patient? So the Medrash seems to imply, yes, it's the mitzvah of Orla. The Torah tells us that when we plant a new fruit-bearing tree, we have to wait 3 years before partaking of those fruits. And as the Ramban suggests that this is a mitzvah about Hakaras HaTov, the Medrash seems to indicate that this is sort of a tikkun. This is a kapara for other Marishons not waiting, because the Eitz Hadas Tovara would have become permissible for me. We would have been able to partake of that fruit. And says the Medrash, use it for Kiddush on Friday night. But he couldn't wait. He couldn't wait. He lacked that patience. And it's important from a Torah perspective to be patient. We sometimes forget and fail to appreciate. Success in relationships, in parenting, in personal growth, so much of that depends on the level of patience we have. You know, it's interesting. When this crisis began, there was such a focus on the coming of Mashiach. Mashiach was coming. Now here again, the record will show that I immediately, from day one, warned against allowing ourselves getting caught up in this craze for several reasons. But it must be noted how quickly that fizzled out and led to moments of profound disappointment and frustration. And I will admit myself, even though I warned you, please don't declare Mashiach is coming right now, we don't know. I'll never forget that literally at the moment of Chatzos, Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh, on the first day of Pesach, Tinek decided for the first time ever to sound that warning signal, that loud alert system. And there was a part of me that absolutely believed that here it was, announcing the arrival of Mashiach. It was really just telling us that there was a high wind alert. Talk about a disappointment. But that excitement, that feeling that, he's here. Where did it go? Are we that impatient? That's so ironic, because Geula is supposed to be a slow and deliberate process with stages and phases and ups and downs and hills and valleys and twists and turns. We say every day, Matzmiach Keren Yeshua. Do you ever sit there and watch a plant grow? You watch a tree grow? It's a process. Kima, slowly. But in this technologically advanced era, we are so accustomed to seeing instant results. We can't wait for anything. But we have to remember that Geula is a process. And yes, on a much more, practical level, the situation that we are facing right now requires a process which demands patience. And what we have learned about ourselves over the past 6 months is that we may not be as patient as we thought we were. Over the past 6 months, it seems to me that we have discovered about ourselves that we are truly very spoiled. And forgive me, I don't know if there's a better word for that. Maybe too comfortable, pampered. On the one hand, again, having the wherewithal and the resources to manage life, demonstrating preparedness in all situations, creating schedules and systems that work for ourselves, that's wonderful. But perhaps, in some respects, we've seen over the past 6 months that we have been afforded more choices and opportunities than we really need. Heading into Purim this past year, we were blessed with a myriad of choices and opportunities and options to choose from. We choose where to daven and when to daven and with whom to learn and what base medrash. We would decide if we're interested in getting together with friends or family for Shabbos, or maybe we're going to have a quiet Shabbos without company. Some of us were still making plans about Pesach. For those of us who were fortunate to be making smachot, there were still decisions from invitations to photographers, from flowers to dresses, would the chuppah be inside or outside, would the bar mitzvah boy lane, or would he daven musaf also? I can go on and on, but you get the point. We were blessed with many, many options. And then suddenly, unexpectedly, it came to a screeching halt. Having many choices, is that a good thing or a bad thing? So for those who remember, I actually spoke about this last year on Shabbat Shuvah, and I'll remind you of a quote that I shared with you then from Peter Drucker, who's a famous educator and author whose writings have contributed to the philosophical and practical foundations of the modern business corporation. And he says, in a few hundred years, when the history of our time will be written, it is likely that the most important event historians will see is not technology, not the internet, not e-commerce. It is an unprecedented change in the human condition. For the first time, literally, substantial and rapidly growing numbers of people have choices. For the first time, they will have to manage themselves, and society is totally unprepared for it. So whether having an abundance of choices in general is good or bad is an interesting subject for another time. But I think that we could all agree that becoming spoiled, in a sense, and not finding it so easy to adapt to fewer choices in some situations, or lack of choice altogether, is not a good thing. And the adjustments that we have had to make in terms of our schedule and lifestyle have ranged from inconvenient for some, for debilitating, perhaps, in some cases. And here again, I'm not looking to pour salt on the wounds of those who are really hurting. But some of us, and I'm speaking to myself certainly, may want to consider whether or not we fuss more about not having the options that we have become accustomed to, or to recognize a sense of resistance and rebelliousness that is sometimes expressed when we are asked to do something that we don't want to do. Which brings me to the next root that has been exposed. We take too much for granted. Hakara Satov. The Ramban teaches that this is one of the most fundamental, if not the most fundamental principle in the entire Torah, to recognize the good that we have in life. Did you ever think about the expression Hakara Satov, which we use to describe expressing our thanksgiving, really only means to recognize? Hakara Satov technically just means just to recognize it. The things that we take for granted, our health, our family, friendships, peace, stability, employment, financial security, the things in life that we take for granted. Tonight, we said Havdalah. Havdalah includes four brachos: the Bari Pri Agafen, the Bari Mebin Samin, Bari Mera'esh, and the Berachos HaMavdil. Three of those clearly fit as part of the Havdalah service. Bari Pri Agafen, we always will include as part of a mitzvah like this. Birchas Hamavdil, of course, Borei Min HaBesamim, we're familiar with the idea, Chazal tell us, that we smell the besamim in order to ease the transition as we lose our Neshama Yaseira. But why are you reciting the Borei Ma'ori Ha'esh as part of Havdalah? We're taught that we recite that Bracha Motzoi Shabbos because Adam HaRishon discovered it was given the gift of creating fire on Motzoi Shabbos. But it has nothing to do with Havdalah. It's not really technically part of Birchas Hamavdil Ben Kodesh L'Chol. Why do we do it then? Why not do it separately? Another question. Adam was created, as we know, on Friday, on Erev Shabbos, the sixth day of creation. It was obviously light at that time. And the Medrash tells us that first Shabbos there was no darkness. 36 hours of light before the world turned dark. And for those 36 hours, Adam was completely surrounded by this penetrating and transcendent light. The Or of Gan Eden was certainly greater than the light that can come from two stones that are rubbed together. So why didn't Adam HaRishon recite a bracha expressing his praise of Borei Ma'ori Esh during those 36 hours? Why did he wait until Motzoi Shabbos? So I once heard a beautiful answer from Rabbi Yisrael Reisman, who said, this reflects a simple yesod in life. It is true that Adam had light, but a person doesn't appreciate what he has unless he feels he's in danger of losing it. And only then does one appreciate what he has. And so, on Motzoi Shabbos, when it got dark, and Adam started to panic because the first time in his life, he couldn't see anything, and he rubs two stones together, and he's given the gift of life, he recites the bracha Borei Ma'ori Esh, and that's why it's part of Havdalah. We realize at the end of Shabbos that we are about to lose something very special, that Neshama Yaseira, the Kiddush of Shabbos, and that pains us. We realize how much we've taken for granted. And that's the way it is in life in general. A person who suffers an injury, a person who can't walk for a period of time, later comes to appreciate that great gift of walking. I hope and pray that each and every one of us, wherever we are right now, can reflect upon the last 6 months as being a slap on our face, an opportunity for us to appreciate the gifts that we have in life. And there are many things that we did not lose during this time period. There are many things that we've been able to maintain and continue to have throughout the entire time. Those gifts of our life as well, we should recognize, we should be makir tov. Another very ugly root that has been exposed over the past 6 months is a root that is probably best described as prejudice, as being too judgmental. And before reflecting specifically on this time period, I think it's worthwhile to note how in general we tend to be very prejudiced people, whether we recognize it or not. There's a lot of discussion these days about racism. I'm not talking about racism per se, but prejudice in a much broader sense. We have very strong biases, which usually reflect some deep-seated values, or perhaps they're confirmed decisions that we've already made, known as confirmation bias. Regardless, we tend to have a lot more prejudice than we think. When it comes to disputes between people, there is always another side to the story. We always have to recognize that whenever we're speaking to somebody, and if we're involved, we're only hearing or seeing one side. And even when we hear both sides, we're not seeing the entire picture. The picture is always incomplete. So many times I've been asked to try to involve myself, to mediate, and I can tell you, rarely, if ever, are things as simple as they appear from a distance. I can give so many examples. I'll give you just one. I remember years ago having a heart-to-heart conversation with an individual who would speak incessantly in shul. He would not stop talking in shul. And you would think for me as the rabbi, that's pretty cut and dry. After all, you know, just stop talking. And I had a conversation with him and I was struck by his response. He spoke to me about his struggle as an adult with ADD, the poor modeling that he had at home, and so much others. Now, none of this is an excuse to talk and to disrupt others. That's not even the point. But I sat there feeling really amazed by the complexity of this situation. People are complex. Situations are complex. So to just stand all the way up there and look down at a guy who's talking and say, "Sha," without recognizing and appreciating the struggles. In the context of this discussion, it is important to reiterate, as Chazal tell us, "Al tadin es chavercha asher tagia lemekomo." Do not judge another person until you are in his place, as we sometimes say, in their shoes. Now, of course, you can never be in someone else's shoes, so the implication is quite clear. Don't judge others. And what people don't always realize is this doesn't mean that I have to adjust or modify my perspective, my views, my values, my halachic understanding, my political views. Chazal warned us, they instruct us, don't judge other people. That doesn't mean that that has to become part of my personal worldview. And what if we find ourselves in situations where we can't judge people positively? We can't be dan sam on the kavschus. So as I once heard in the name of Rav Nevensol, who says you need to judge at all? Don't judge at all. It's not our job. But we have much prejudice. And I think a lot of that has come out over the past 6 months. The way we express our disagreements to and with each other. I'm not interested in addressing the particular issues that have united us and divided us over the past 6 months. I think that you can all think of some very relevant, timely examples. But watching these conversations take place should give us all reason to pause. Seriously pause. Now, again, understandably, things have been stressful on a multitude of levels. And this does not always bring out the best in us. On the other hand, the tone of the conversations has escalated at times to reflect a lack of appreciation of the complexities that I just mentioned that are inherent in virtually every situation. The nuances, the subtleties, the small and seemingly insignificant factors that actually make all the difference in the world. Imagine a person who has committed an act of murder and they are on trial for their life. They appear before a bezin, you know, a Jewish court that is tasked with being dandin and defashos has 23 judges. And the 23 judges gather and they listen to the evidence and to the testimony, they see everything, and they come to a conclusion immediately that this person is to be convicted. This person is chayiv misa without a doubt. There is absolutely, there's no mitigating factors over here whatsoever. Nobody can find any tzad zchus. Says the Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Yud Zayin, Amar of Kahana, Sanhedrin Shiro Kula Lechova, Pochrin Oso. It leads automatically to an acquittal. We cannot convict a person if no one can find a tzad zchus. That's not possible. And the Gemara goes on to say later on in that daf, in the name of Rav, in Moshivin b'Sanhedrin elamishio de'el taher es asheretz min haTorah. In order to be qualified to sit on the Sanhedrin, you have to know how to be matayer. You have to be able to make a case to purify a sheretz which the Torah says is tameh. What does that mean? The Torah says it's tameh. I'm smarter than the Torah. Says the Shem Yishmuel, from the time of the Achilat Eis Hadas, everything in the world has mixtures of tov and ra. There is nothing that is completely tov and there is nothing that is completely ra. There is, of course, rov. Without a doubt, there are many things that we call ra because it's rov ra. There are many things that we call tov because of the tov ra, because of the rov tov. He says that somebody who is appointed in Sanhedrin must have the ability, must have the sensitivity to look at a situation, to analyze it, and realize and to recognize there is kedusha here. There is a tzad to be matayer a sheretz. I'm not going to paskin that way. I'm not going to actually be matayer the sheretz, but I see it as a possibility. There is something there. And the Shem Shmuel and others say that connects back to the first point. You can't look at a person who's arguing, whatever the case is, this guy is a murderer. He's guilty, without a doubt. He's got blood on his hands, literally. And you cannot find a tzad zuchus? That is a simon that you are not fit to sit on the Sanhedrin. Now, granted, we are not all members of the Sanhedrin. Fair. But we can be inspired, at the very least, to recognize that matters are profoundly complex. And we have seen again and again over the past 6 months how so many people are just unwilling to recognize that complexity. And if you think that I'm referring to something in particular issue or position, you're reading into my words too much. The truth of the matter is, this could be said about much of what we observed over the past 6 months. But we have been offered a great opportunity to reflect and to see a side of ourselves, the way in which we judge each other, the way in which we speak to each other, the way we speak about each other. It behooves us to ask ourselves the question as to whether or not this is who we want to be. Are we, as parents and as teachers, modeling the sorts of behaviors that we want our children and our students to emulate? The Maharal in the Sefer Baragola gives us instructions and guidelines as to how we should argue with somebody we disagree with. And while the Maharal was not talking about issues of social distancing and wearing masks and whether or not you think kids should or should not play together, he was talking about things, you'll forgive me, that are probably more important. The Maharal is talking about other things, matters of spiritual life and death. Having conversations with an apikoris, having conversations with somebody about some of the most basic and fundamentals of our belief system. Says the Maharal, Roy Mishayirsa Ladun Bidin HaEmes, Shulo Yemachas Labal Machlokusa. When you're having a conversation with somebody, no matter what you're discussing, don't get angry. Roy Chshem Modelo, Chomelolov, Umedaber Imo Benachas. You should be generous to this person. Let him go first. Have a sincere conversation. But if you don't listen and you just reject what another person has to say, you push him away, you don't let him talk, this will weaken the argument. Because they're going to say, oh, that's why you're pushing off, because you know I'm right. And we see this again and again. And says the Maharal, especially if the person who is arguing with you, they're not arguing with because they're trying to be right. This is what they believe. Don't say al tedaber, which means be quiet, or tistom diver picha, which, like you said, I don't want to say the words. Like we say today, be quiet, shut your mouth. Says the Maharal Shem Kein Lo Yeh Biur Adas. You want to get to the truth? Have civil conversations. Unfortunately, everywhere around us, civil discord is completely deteriorating. Cancel culture. And it has seeped its way into our community, and it's starting to affect us in profound ways. We have to monitor the tone of our discourse very carefully, or we will continue to split and splinter, and God forbid become a polarized community. We were very close 6 months ago, and I am watching and I am seeing, I'm sure I'm not the only one, within shuls, within schools, sometimes neighbors, and even within the same family, a decay and erosion that is taking place. It doesn't have to happen. It does not have to happen. I believe another root that has been exposed is that we have a really hard time being alone. Now, of course, that's not always a bad thing. As mentioned, we are fortunate to be part of a community in which we are able to support each other and assist each other, particularly in times of need. And of course, it must be noted, not just as a disclaimer, but it must be said, that there are unfortunately individuals who have had to suffer long times, periods of time being alone, and we should not be dismissive of that in any way. But for some of us, perhaps this period of time revealed to us how much we depend on being around other people for conversation, for distraction, and as a replacement of what moments of solitude are supposed to do for us. Now, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, famous Gemara, teaches that Rosh Hashanah Koboy Olam Ovrin Lefanav Kivnei Marom, that we all pass before the Ribbono Shel Olam on Rosh Hashanah as a single individual. And there's a lot to be said about that. We say in the Rosh Hashanah, Kivakaras Ro Edro, Mavi Yitzono Tachas Shivto. That theme continues through Yom Kippur, because Yom HaKippurim, in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, was a day that was observed in the most unique way, primarily by one individual who would experience the majesty of the day is a sole individual. If naiv lifnim, no one could go with the Kohen Gadol into the Kodesh Kadashim. It was experienced in solitude. And to a certain extent, that is an ideal. There is a big part of our avodas Hashem, just avodas people, of knowing how to function, how to be, how to exist, how to thrive alone. Some of you may recall that in the past I shared with you an article that I first saw about 15 years ago. It's called The End of Solitude by William Dershowitz. And I'm not going to read it again, much of it right now, but just a quote. He speaks about loneliness and boredom, similar terms. And he says that they are characteristically modern. He points out, very interesting, that the Oxford English Dictionary's earliest citations of either word in the contemporary sense dates from the 19th century, relatively recent usage of the word. Suburbanization, by eliminating the stimulation as well as the sociability of urban or traditional village life, exasperated the tendency to both. But the great age of boredom, I believe, came in with television, precisely because television was designed to palliate that feeling. Boredom is not a necessary consequence of having nothing to do. It is only the negative experience of that state. Television, by obviating the need to learn how to make use of one's lack of occupation, precludes one from ever discovering how to enjoy it. In fact, it renders that condition fearsome, its prospect intolerable. You are terrified of being bored, So you turn on the television. And he goes on to say that the internet did the same thing to solitude. That loneliness is not the absence of company, it is the grief over that absence. And if 6 hours of television creates the aptitude for boredom, the inability to sit still, 100 text messages a day, which today is thousands, creates the aptitude for loneliness, the inability to be by yourself. And I think that this crisis has highlighted this reality, at least for myself, and I'm sure for many others as well. There is an important part of our life which must be experienced when we are alone. When we are your forgive me, this is not intended to sound in any way hurtful, or when we are socially distant. There is a benefit on a certain level, not necessarily like this, and not for extended periods of time, and not, but there are benefits to social distance. Rav Volbe in the Sefer Al Yeshua talks about bedidus not as something that only, you know, Chachmei HaKabbalah who want to go ahead and wander into Gullus and live by themselves in a cave for a few months. Real people who have to find moments of his bodidus where they just spend a little time by themselves. And he says, the ability to do so is an indicator, it's a test as to how healthy, spiritually healthy I am. If I am the kind of person who can actually be alone and experience that in a meaningful way, that is a sign, he says, that I am a bal seichel iyuni, that I am a thoughtful, analytical, and a spiritually healthy individual. But he says, unfortunately, many people run, they flee from moments of bedidus, like one is boreach min ha'esh, because they come face to face with a stranger and it's a very uncomfortable feeling. This period of time, and it's been difficult and challenging, this period of time has reminded us, I believe, how much we have to become comfortable by ourselves at times. And finally, if you're counting, I think this is number 8. A very concerning root that has been exposed. I think in some ways this is the most significant and important of all over the past 6 months, is to see how much faith we put in experts. You know, over the past 6 months, we have become very dependent and reliant on experts of all different types, physicians ranging from pulmonologists to epidemiologists, from pediatricians to emergency room doctors. We have watched closely the various policymakers, educators, professional leaders, rabbinic leaders, lay leaders. And as I mentioned already, in many cases, we ourselves have become the experts. I have become the expert on all these matters. I don't need to listen to others. I have read enough articles and read enough studies, and I've studied the data, and I myself are the experts. We become expert educators, we become expert doctors, we become expert parents, expert children, we're experts. Maybe, though, we're missing the point entirely. Maybe we're putting too much focus on the experts. Can you imagine if we would simply latch on to the most expert advice and opinion that exists in the universe, and then, and only then, we will find our way towards the salvation that we are looking for? I think that this is arguably the most startling and frightening revelation of all. The past 6 months have revealed to us how dependent we are upon expert advice and guidance, but fail to display a proper degree of dependence upon the expert who created all experts. There is only one expert in the universe. And we put so much faith and reliance and dependence in the next article that we are going to read that we have forgotten. In Lanu Ami Lihisha'ein Ela Alavinu Shebashemayim. When Rachel Imenu was desperate to have children, she tried everything that she could in ancient times. There was no fertility clinic that she could go to. There were very, very limited resources as far as science is concerned. She davened and she prayed. But she basically put all of her faith in the greatest expert that she had in her life, her husband, Yaakov Avinu, who was an expert mispalel. He was an individual who had a very close relationship with the Ribbono Shalom. And at a moment of tremendous grief and weakness and struggling, she said to him, Havali banim, give me children, Yaakov, v'im ayin mesa anochi. And if not, if you don't carry through with this request, I'm going to die. Vayicharaf Yaakov baRachel. The Torah tells us that Yaakov became angry with Rachel. And he says, Atachas Elokim anochi. What do you think, that I'm God? Asher mona mimech privaten? Now Chazal tell us that Yaakov was punished for the way he spoke to his wife, seemingly very insensitive. But why did he say that? Why did Yaakov speak to his wife in what seems to be such an insensitive way? And in fact, Rashi highlights the insensitivity even more by basically saying that Yaakov says, listen, honey, I have children. I have children with other wives. Clearly you're the one with the problem. What are you asking me? I can't help you. Again, the greatest insensitivity we could imagine. So in the Sefer Darash David, Rav Hofstadter suggests that we can understand this based on the Malbim. The Malbim in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, based on the opening chapter of Sefer Shmuel that we read on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, the Malbim has a similar question. Why is it that when Chana was so desperate for children, and she turns to her husband, Elkanah, and she looks at him for some support, he basically says to her, don't worry, don't worry. What does he say? He says, "What? I'm better from you. Halo anochi tov lach me asara banim. You have me, it's better than 10 children. Again, seemingly very insensitive. So the Malbim explains that Elkanah said that to his wife, not because he was trying to be cruel and insensitive, because he recognized that she was putting too much faith in him. And he said to her, don't have faith in me. He wanted her to feel a greater sense of desperation and gently sort of pushed her in a way that must have been incredibly painful for her. But on that day, she was maras nafesh, vatispalel Hashem v'chotiv ke v'atito neder, as a pasuk tells us, she cried and davened like she never did before because she recognized in lanu amili hisha'ein ela alavinu shebashemayim. Rav Hofstadter suggests that's exactly what Yaakov did. He did the very same thing. He wasn't trying to be cruel and insensitive to his wife, although he was punished nonetheless. But he basically said to her, I can't help you, I'm not God. Hasachas Elokim Anochi. If you want something, ask God. He's the expert. He's the one who you should be relying on. But Itzel Mivlajan explains that's exactly why the Pasuk tells us that in Sefer Shemos, Vayhi Bayamim Arabim Ahim, Vayomes Melech Mitzrayim, Vayayonchu Bnei Yisrael, Menavodah Vizak Vatavash HaVasam El Elokim. On that day, when finally the people of Mitzrayim cried out and God heard their cries, what was so unique about that day? Paro died. So what? So Itzel Mivlajan says that as long as Paro was alive, they said maybe when he dies, the next king will be better. And then the next king comes and it's the same thing, only worse. And they said, oi, we have no one to turn to. There are no experts left. And on that day they cried and they davened like they never did before. And you know what? Batal shavasam el ho'elokim. One more, Mar Malcolm, if you'll indulge me for one more moment. The Gemara in Megillah asks, why is it Marasa Esther Shezimnas Haman? Why did Esther invite Haman to the palace? And that fateful day when she was meeting with Achashverosh, why Haman? What was his role in there? Says Reb Nechemia, "Kedei sheloyomu Yisrael achos yesh lanu beveis hamalach biyasichu daitem en arachamim." Because Esther did not want all of the Jews in the world to assume, well, we have a friend in the palace, we have a friend in the White House, and so therefore we don't have to worry about davening. We could have a hesach hadas men arachamim, and so therefore she invited Haman to confuse them, to throw them off. So they should recognize and appreciate it doesn't make a difference who the president of the United States is. And yes, I say this to you 6 weeks before the election. And don't misunderstand what I'm saying. Of course you should vote. I don't care who you vote for. And there's something that you need to know. It doesn't matter who you vote for. And it doesn't matter who wins. Of course there are consequences. But forget it. Lev Malachim Biyad Hashem. Do we think for a moment that the one who is sitting in the White House is running the world? Oy lanu, that we should think such a thing. In lanu, amili hisha'ein ala alavinu shebashamayim. The last 6 months has revealed the extent to which we depend so much on expert opinion and expert advice. And don't misunderstand me. We need experts. I'm not suggesting that we should never go to doctors and we shouldn't listen to them and be suspicious of everything they're saying. God forbid. But is that what we are truly relying on to the exclusion of the expert with a capital E? The Mishnah Masechta Sota teaches, Be'ikvos HaMashiach, at the time, before the coming of the Mashiach, chutzpah yazgeh. There's going to be rampant chutzpah in the world. The economy is going to be completely haywire. Hamalchus tehapech leminos. Government agencies, government leaders will become completely transformed into minos, into people who seem to be nothing but completely power-hungry and interested in their own self-interest to the exclusion of everything else. Ein tochacha beizvad yihi aliznus. There seems to be nobody who's willing to accept another opinion. Nobody's willing to accept rebuke. You argue with somebody and you get canceled. And not only do we cancel you, we contact your advertisers. And we cancel them as well. V'chachma sofrim tisrach v'yirei chet yimasu v'emes tei naderes. Ha'emes today naderes. You tell me which channel you can get the news right now where you listen to anything that is close to MS. We live in an Alma de Shikra in which there is no MS to be found in the world. Na'arim p'nei zakenim yabinu zakenim yamdu b'nei k'tanim p'nei adar k'pnei kelev ha'benin m'sbayish me'aviv, says the Mishnah. Total, topsy-turvy world in which the young people with less experience stand and they push away those with experience and knowledge and wisdom. And this is the norm of the day. And just when you think the Mishnah is about to end and leave us feeling a sense of great depression and despondency, Va'ami yesh lanu lihisha'ein, says the Mishnah, Alavinu shebashamayim. Be'ikvus of the Mishicha, the Mishnah tells us, things get so bad. Things get so bad. And you know why they get so bad? Because we're supposed to be pushed to the brink where we feel in lanu amilu hisha'in ella alavinu shebashamayim. Who am I going to rely on? Find me an expert. Find me a leader. Find me somebody in the world who can make sense out of this. Who can explain to me what's going on, or when it's going to end, and what comes next, and what is the answer? Says the Mishnah, "Ein lanu amilu hisha'ein elo alavinu shebashamayim." Stop looking. Stop depending so much on the experts. That's, the Mishnah seems to imply, that's the point of all this. In the days before the coming of Mashiach, whenever he comes, afapisha yismameya, in those days, HaKadosh Baruch Hu pushes us to the end. We look around at a world and we say, oy, there's nothing to be hopeful for here. I have no choice. Almi lehisha'en ela alavinu shebashamayim. I want to say one more thing in conclusion. When I was, I think, 15 years old, perhaps 16 years old, my NCSY chapter advisor shared with me a book, a small little book by Aryeh Kaplan. We studied it together, by Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan. It's called If You Were God. And at the time, as a 15 or 16 year old, it actually made quite an impression on me. Fascinating book. I think it probably was one of the first books by Aryeh Kaplan that I'd ever seen. Maybe that was actually the first one. And I kid you not, I haven't thought about that book in over 30 years. Several weeks ago, maybe about a month or two ago, someone from the shul asked me if I have any books by Aryeh Kaplan. And I happen to have two copies of the Aryeh Kaplan anthology. So she returned it. I gave her one and she just returned it, maybe Erev Shabbos. So today, I just noticed it. It was on the dining room table. And I just opened it up. And lo and behold, there's that book, If You Were God. And with your indulgence and your permission, we're just about the 1 hour mark, but I'm just going to read you one page, the opening page of If You Were God. If you've seen this before, you probably remember it. If you haven't, I think you'll appreciate it. And I hope you'll appreciate why I'm sharing this with you. So, If You Were God starts with section number one called The Problem. You are given an island where several tribes live. By nature and culture, these tribes are exploitive and belligerent. This results in much suffering on the island caused by war, poverty, and prejudice. They have been living this way for centuries without any signs of improvement. Your assignment, to try to improve this society, to teach its members to live together in harmony and reduce suffering to a minimum or eliminate it entirely, to create a healthy society. Your resources. You have all the resources that a highly advanced technology can offer. You have the entire island under surveillance, and can see what is happening in any place at any time. You have such devices as cloud seeding equipment and can plant underground explosives. Within reason, you can control weather, flooding, volcanoes, and earthquakes and produce any natural phenomenon on cue. You also have devices that can be used to implant ideas through subliminal suggestion. You can implant ideas to entire populations or to certain select leaders. However, you must take into account the severe limitations of subliminal suggestion. If you are to implant any ideas that go against the basic nature of the populace, they will be totally rejected and your efforts will be in vain. One alternative would be to implant ideas that somehow would make use of the acknowledged bad nature of these people. And finally, your restrictions. Under no circumstances are the natives of this island to be aware of your presence. This supersedes all other considerations. The cultural shock caused by your revealing yourself would disrupt the entire fabric of the island culture. It would cause much suffering and more than offset any good that you could possibly accomplish. The natives would be reduced to a state of almost vegetable-like dependence from which they would be unlikely to recover. If they did recover, they might rebel so violently as to eliminate any positive values that they may have originally had. Therefore, the restriction that you not reveal yourself must be followed without exception under any circumstances. But aside from this restriction, you have a free hand to proceed as humanely or as ruthlessly as you see fit. In short, you have the opportunity to play God. What would you do? That's not the end of the book. If you would like to explore further, well, now you know I have a copy. I'm happy to lend it to you. Tufshin Pei, 5780, was a difficult year. But it was a year in which we were able to get a closer look at ourselves and discover things that we should really want to know about ourselves. We are living through a time of great frustration and pain and difficulty and uncertainty and confusion. But I ask you to consider the possibility that we are the natives on an island in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu is trying, as Rabbi Kaplan says so poignantly, to accomplish three things: to improve the society, to teach its members to live together in harmony and reduce suffering to a minimum or eliminate it entirely, and finally to create a healthy society. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows what he's doing. The question is, do we? And he has given us an incredible gift. He has given us the ability to notice and discover things about ourselves. The purpose of tshuva is not only to correct our actions, it's not only to adjust our behaviors, but to go down deeper, like the Rambam in Hilchos Deos, as the Navi Yeshayahu tells us, Yazov Rasha Darko, not just his ways, not just his actions, not just his deeds, but who he is, his values, the way he thinks, the way he feels, who he is as a person. May we be zocha be'ezras Hashem to grow and to learn and to raise ourselves. Yes, we daven as we should with every fiber of our being. Avinu malkeinu minah magefa minachlosecha. But as far as we can tell, we are still experiencing on some level the effects of this terrible magefa. But there has been an incredible opportunity that we've been offered. We have been offered the opportunity to see ourselves in a way that we have never before. And if we really, 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 really want to get the most of this situation, if we want this tshuva season to be like none other, if we want it to be unprecedented in scope, not only because of the fact that it follows such a miserable year, but because we have been offered an opportunity to discover worlds within ourselves that we never knew existed. And now that I know that they're there, I can begin the process of beginning to adjust and to correct and to address a derech, a deya, a mida, not just an action, not just a habit, but a part of myself, so that I could become, going down the list that we started before, a little more patient, so that I become a little more civil in my conversations with other people, so I learn to appreciate what I have and not take everything for granted, so I could recognize and appreciate that I don't control everything in the world, and the world is, in fact, more often than not, uncertain. And most importantly, to remember that I cannot rely on anyone, and I should not rely on anyone. Ela, alavinu sheva shemayim. If there was one message that we can take with us from the year 5780, Tafshin Pei, it is that. It is those last words in the Mishnah Sota, Perek Tes, Mishnah Tezvav, Ami Lahisha, Yesh Lanu Lahisha Ein, Alavino Sheba Shemayim. I wish each and every one of you, and each and every one of us, and our families, and our communities, and all of Klal Yisrael, Mishnas Bracha B'Shalom, a year of peace, a year of health, a year of clarity, a year of order, a year of Seder, a year of return to normalcy, but not the normalcy that we knew a year or two ago. The normalcy that we've been davening for, the normalcy of Simcha Liyatzecha, V'sasan Liyrecha, V'simlo Chato Hashem Levadecha, the normalcy that we will experience at the time of the Gula Shlema V'Amitis, B'mehei Rav Yomeinu. Thank you, Gmar Chasima Tova to all.